From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Today, the escalating battle between Congress and the White House over the destruction of the CIA interrogation videotapes. We'll speak with House Judiciary Chair John Conyers. We'll also ask him about increasing calls for impeachment. Then, a controversy Mike Huckabee doesn't like to talk about.
My name is Lois Davidson. My daughter won't be home for Christmas this year.
Lois Davidson, her daughter Carol Sue Shields, was murdered by Wayne Dumond in 1999. As governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee aggressively pushed for the early release of Dumond, despite being warned by numerous women he'd sexually assaulted them or their family members and would likely strike again. Lois Davidson joins us to talk about the case. But first, we'll get the latest on the latest in New Orleans. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration's told 17 states across the country they cannot impose their own standards for limiting greenhouse gas emissions from automobiles. The California-led effort seeks to cut vehicles' dioxide emissions 30% by 2016. But on Wednesday, Environmental Protection Agency head Stephen Johnson overruled the proposals and said they're trumped by federal authority. The Washington Post reports Johnson's decision came over the objection of his lawyers and policy staff. In a briefing, aides told the EPA would likely lose in court if California sued to protect its emission standards. Aides also told Johnson the EPA is almost certain to win if he didn't intervene and allow automakers to sue California instead. The decision came just hours after President Bush signed the new bipartisan energy bill. Bush hailed the law at a White House ceremony.
The bill I signed today takes a significant step because it will require fuel producers to use at least 36 billion gallons of biofuel in 2022. This is nearly a five-fold increase over current levels. It will help us diversify our energy supplies and reduce our dependence on oil. It's an important part of this legislation.
The new energy law requires car manufacturers to meet fuel economy standards of 35 miles per gallon for both cars and trucks. The California standard is higher, 43 miles per gallon for cars and some light trucks. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says states will go to court to reverse the EPA order. Environmental groups blasted the EPA's decision. Paul Court of Earth Justice said, quote, "This is not about protecting a national policy to address global warming. This is about the White House protecting industry cronies from state leaders who actually want to fight global warming." The CIA has announced it'll begin handing over documents to Congress about the destruction of videotapes showing the interrogation of two prisoners held in secret jails. The announcement came after the House Intelligence Committee threatened to subpoena CIA officials if they refused to appear voluntarily. The Intelligence Committee has launched an investigation into the tapes in defiance of a Bush administration request to await White House probe. More on that story after headlines. In Iraq, at least 12 people have been killed and 10 wounded in a suicide attack in the province of Diyala, north of Baghdad. Iraqi police say U.S. soldiers could be among the dead. The attack follows another Diyala suicide bombing that killed at least 16 people and wounded nearly 30 others.
7 members of my family were killed. Can Arabs accept that? Can any law approve it?
How many members of your family were killed?
7, my 6 brothers and my son.
Pentagon figures show an average 600 attacks per week in Iraq, excluding U.S. attacks. A recent U.S. military study shows Iraqis of all sectarian and ethnic groups roundly see the U.S. invasion and occupation as the root cause of Iraq's sectarian conflict. One U.S. military analyst said the result is encouraging because it shows Iraqis hold some shared beliefs. Turkey's ambassador to the United States is praising the Bush administration for aiding Turkish airstrikes on Kurdish positions in northern Iraq. The White House has denied reports it shared intelligence gathered from aircraft and unmanned drones. But on Wednesday, Turkish ambassador Nabi Sensoy said the attacks were possible because of U.S. information. on Capitol Hill. Justice Department officials are coming under criticism for refusing to attend a hearing on allegations of rape and sexual assault of female contractors in Iraq. A former employee has sued Halliburton and its former subsidiary, KBR, after she says she was gang-raped by employees of the company in Baghdad. The alleged victim, Jamie Lee Jones, accuses the company and the U.S. government of covering up the crime. On Wednesday, government officials skipped a House Judiciary Committee hearing into the charges. Committee Chair John Conyers called the absence a disgrace. In Britain, three newly freed prisoners jailed for more than 4 years at Guantanamo arrived in London Wednesday, where they were promptly taken into police custody. All three previously resided in Britain before their capture. The Abdener Samour, an Algerian, and Omar Degaez, a Libyan, were seized in Pakistan. Attorneys say Degaez has been left blind in one eye from beatings by U.S. guards. The third prisoner, Jamil Abana, was seized in Gambia. Zachary Katznelson, an attorney with the prisoner rights group Reprieve, said Abana has yet to meet his youngest daughter.
I saw Jamil just on December 7th, so just a little more than 10 days ago. And speaking to him, you know, he's never met his youngest daughter. She's 5 years old now. His wife was pregnant when he was taken by the CIA. The idea of holding her in his arms, kissing her, it just brought tears to his eyes. And it's going to be a wonderful reunion this evening.
The prisoner's return follows years of campaigning by their families. In Israel and the occupied territories, the Israeli government appears to have dismissed a new truce offer from Hamas. The offer was relayed through an Israeli television reporter. The reporter announced this week Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh said he would prevent rocket fire from Gaza if Israel stopped the killing of Palestinians and lifted its blockade. Haniyeh's overture came one day after Israeli airstrikes killed at least 10 Palestinians in Gaza. Israel says most of the dead were militants. In response to Haniyeh, an Israeli government spokesperson said it would only deal with the Palestinian Authority led by President Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas lost control of Gaza to Hamas takeover in June. A new government audit has concluded that U.S. sanctions on Cuba are more restrictive than those on any other country, including Iran and North Korea. The Government Accountability Office study also says the resources poured into enforcing the Cuban embargo may undermine national security by diverting attention from actual terrorist threats. More than 60% of cases investigated by the Office of Foreign Assets Control focused on blocking Cuban goods, such as rum and cigars. The study was carried out at the request of Democratic Congressmembers Charles Rangel of New York and Barbara Lee of California. In a statement, Rangel said, quote, I am dismayed to learn the Bush administration's Cuba policies have led Homeland Security and Treasury to direct scarce resources at such trivial violations, particularly when we know that our nation's borders remain vulnerable to real threats such as drugs and weapons. In Argentina, eight former military officers have been sentenced to terms up to 25 years for crimes under the military dictatorship from 1976 to 1983. Former military general Cristino Nicolaides was given 25 years for the murder of five leftist militants. He's the highest-ranking official to be convicted since Argentina repealed an amnesty law 4 years ago. And back here in the United States, a new candidate on the campaign trail. Former Democratic Congressmember Cynthia McKinney has announced she's seeking the presidency as a Green Party hopeful. In a campaign video, McKinney said her former party has become identical with the Republicans.
The Democrats do not speak for us. They have abdicated their sacred responsibilities to the American people, to the Constitution, and to the global community. The Democrats, no different than their Republican counterparts, eat out of the hands of corrupt lobbyists and feed at the same corporate trough. I am proud to say that the Green Party is my new political home.
McKinney was the first African-American woman elected to Congress from Georgia. One of her last measures in office was to introduce a bill for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. The CIA has announced it will begin handing over documents to Congress about the destruction of videotapes showing the interrogation of two prisoners held in secret jails. The announcement came after the House Intelligence Committee threatened to subpoena agency officials if they wouldn't appear before the committee voluntarily. In a direct challenge to President Bush, the panel rejected a Bush administration request that it defer to a preliminary White House inquiry and has launched its own investigation into the videotape destruction. The CIA says it destroyed the tapes to protect interrogators, but questions remain over whether it was part of a cover-up to mask evidence of torture. Committee Chairman Sylvester Reyes wants acting CIA General Counsel John Rizzo and the former head of the National Clandestine Service, Jose Rodriguez, to testify on January 16th. Rodriguez is the official who directed that the tapes be destroyed.
Meanwhile, the New York Times revealed Wednesday that at least four top White House lawyers took part in talks about whether to destroy the tapes. The officials taking part included then White House counsel and later Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, David Addington, then counsel to Vice President Dick Cheney, now as Chief of Staff, John Bellinger, then a senior lawyer at the National Security Council, and Harriet Myers, then President Bush's Deputy Chief of Staff and later White House counsel. At a news conference, White House Press Secretary Dana Perino denied she'd misled reporters about White House involvement in the tape destruction.
I am not accountable for all the anonymous sources that you turn up. I'm not. I am accountable. I speak for the president and for the White House. This says that I was misleading, and I was not.
It doesn't say you. It doesn't say you at all. And there were other people in the administration.
The White House is not comment. The only thing that I have said from this podium is regarding to the president and his recollection. And if CNN has different information that they want to provide to me that contradicts what I've said, you know, let's see it.
Meanwhile, a federal judge has summoned Justice Department lawyers to his courtroom on Friday to determine whether the destruction of the tapes violated a court order to preserve evidence about detainees. We go now to Capitol Hill, where we're joined by Congressmember John Conyers. He's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. We're also joined by Ray McGovern. He is a 27-year career analyst with the CIA. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Chairman Conyers, we're going to begin with you. Talk about what your plans are right now with this latest news of White House involvement.
Well, what we're planning to do, and we were even before the news you gave us, Amy, was revealed, is hold hearings so that the public can get in on what's really going on here. The fact that there's been a secret meeting in the Senate Intelligence Committee, thank goodness for the bipartisan efforts in the House Intelligence Committee, we're now beginning to see some light, but I'm holding a public hearing today, this morning, in Judiciary, in which we examine not just the obstruction of justice possibilities in destroying hundreds of hours of tape, that it's unclear how and why that was done, but more importantly, what was on them, which could result in us reviewing a lot of the federal criminal laws that could be involved in the interrogation and the torture laws that we worked so hard, even with the Supreme Court, to get the president and this administration to honor.
And Ray McGovern, you're a 27-year career veteran analyst with the CIA. Given the fact that four key people in the White House staff had knowledge of this, is it conceivable that the vice president and the president did not?
It's not conceivable to me. However, the president doesn't recollect a lot of things, and I'm not surprised that his spokesperson would say that he doesn't recollect this either. The interest in obstruction of justice and what's on the tapes is certainly interesting, but the subject of torture, which is what is being covered up, has been around for 3.5 years, starting with Richard Clark's revelation that on the very evening of 9/11, the president was told Richard Clark and Don Rumsfeld, "I don't care what the international lawyers say, we're going to kick some ass." That was followed, that revelation came in the spring of 2004, followed very quickly by Abu Ghraib and by revelations of a different kind, namely the texts of the memoranda written by David Addington but signed by Alberto Gonzalez, which told the president, in my opinion, the war on terror creates a new paradigm which makes the provisions of the Geneva protections for prisoners of war obsolete and some of those provisions quaint. Now, we should have known from that. That was 25 January 2002. And just 2 weeks later, on February 7, 2002, the president took that advice, issued a directive which said, we shall treat prisoners, quote, humanely, as appropriate, and as consistent with military necessity, period, end quote. That's not what Geneva says. That is the loophole through which Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney drove the Mack truck of torture. That's what we should be concerned about. That's been around for 3.5 years.
Chairman Conyers, on the issue of the destruction of the videotapes, the new Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, has said Congress should not be investigating because it will obstruct the Justice Department's investigation. You're head of the House Judiciary Committee. Your response?
Well, that's precisely one of the things we're inquiring into. Unless this is going to be a completely new circumstance in the relations between the three branches of government, it's not possible for us to avoid overlapping inquiries. And it's happened frequently, and it happens all the time. So if we're going to have to wait till they finish an investigation, by the way, which Mukasey, as a judge, was tangentially, at the least, involved in some of this, he's the one that ought to step aside. As a matter of fact, one of the big questions that are now before us is whether or not we should get a special prosecutor so that the Department of Justice's conflicts and or potential conflicts can be set aside, and we have a thorough, in-depth examination.
Congressman Conyers, I wanted to turn to another controversial issue, one that you've been dealing with and have over time, that issue of impeachment. Now, three Democratic members of your committee, of the House Judiciary Committee, Robert Wexler of Florida, Luis Gutierrez of Illinois, Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, have called on you to begin impeachment hearings against Vice President Dick Cheney. This week, Congressman Wexler said the charges against the vice president are too serious to ignore.
It is time for the House Judiciary Committee to hold impeachment hearings for Vice President Cheney. We have an obligation to ask questions to determine whether, in fact, the vice president purposefully manipulated intelligence, bringing us into war, whether he knowingly ordered the illegal use of torture, whether he knowingly exposed covert agents for political purposes, whether he obstructed federal investigations. These charges are too serious to ignore.
Since last week, over 100,000 people have signed a petition on Congressman Wexler's website supporting impeachment hearings. And we're wondering, Congressman Conyers, now with your committee members taking up this issue, an issue that you actually long championed, what your feelings are today. Will you be supporting them in this?
Well, no, but there are a lot of things that can and will be done. We're documenting the transgressions and errors of the administration in the Department of Justice, which have led to the firing of 9 U.S. attorneys. We're looking at the protections of the right to vote. The election is coming up. We've got to protect everybody's right to get out here and make a choice and make sure that it's counted.
Why stop short of hearings on impeachment?
Well, because unless we're going to impeach the vice president and the president within this space of time, I think we could be very seriously compromising the greatest, most important thing, in addition to documenting any misdeeds that may have happened, whether we continue to have Bush enablers continue to shatter and tear the Constitution to shreds. And so All of this academically is great. I've got a number of books from my friends about which articles would be best and which ones we should go after more. But it seems to me that the time element and also the feasibility of whether or not there is any possible chance of success. There is a very stark reality that with the corporatization of the media, we could end up with turning people who should be documented in history as making many profound errors and violating the Constitution from villains into victims. And those are the kinds of considerations that have entered my mind in thinking about this process, Amy.
And Ray McGovern, you've been outspoken on this issue, and given the new evidence now about the destruction of the CIA tapes and the White House staff, some staff involvement in that, your sense of the impeachment situation?
Well, we not only have the obstruction of justice, but we have the president's former spokesman saying that he was involved in the outing of Valerie Plame. We also have the president threatening World War III on bogus evidence that Iran was developing a nuclear weapons development program. So, you know, it's sort of like outrage fatigue. Where do you begin? Well, where I would begin is with the demonstrably impeachable offenses. First and foremost, the president's not only admission, but his bragging about violating the laws against eavesdropping on Americans without a court warrant. He bragged that he did that 30 times. That was one of the articles of impeachment voted against President Nixon. Similarly, disregarding subpoenas, that too was one of the articles voted against President Nixon in the Judiciary Committee, where Congressman Conyers, of course, served very loyally. So you have those two right there, and that's not even mentioning forging, manufacturing, coming up with false intelligence to deceive congressmen and senators out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or to otherwise authorize war. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that. And so my sense is that our founders are probably turning over in their grave at this point because they put the impeachment clause in the declarative mood, not the subjunctive mood. They didn't
But Ray McGovern, what about the argument that that Congressman Conyers raises, that given the short amount of time left in the term of the president and the difficulty of actually being able to vote out an impeachment, that it would divert much of the attention of the Democratic Party in a way that would not necessarily lead to victory?
I think what I hear Congressman Conyers saying is that Fox News would have a field day if he didn't get 218 votes right off the bat. That is not an explanation, in my view. If you read Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution, which I think should be the document we abide by, it says, the president, vice president, other senior officials shall be removed from office upon impeachment for and conviction of high crimes and misdemeanors. Congressman Conyers and his staff a year ago came up with a 350-page indictment of all the offenses against the Constitution that Bush had already been guilty of. So I don't really understand the delay. I'm wondering if there isn't some sort of crass political reason for it, namely, don't make any waves. The president's numbers are in the toilet. The vice president's numbers are flushed down the toilet. Just don't do anything at all so that Fox News will have nothing to seize upon in accusing the Democrats of being divisive or something like that. I don't think that's the right constitutional approach. And I feel very strongly about that, and many of my colleagues do as well.
Congressman Congressman Conyers, more than 100,000 people signed the impeachment petition on Congressman Wexler, your colleague, in the House Judiciary Committee's website. Your response to this growing call in the United States?
Well, I've been monitoring the growing call. I've been going to many meetings to talk about this, but this isn't a Fox 2 event. As bad as they may be, it doesn't mean that the rest of them won't chime in as well. And I think that that has a great deal to do with whether we're going to continue Bush enablers of in the White House. And to me, that is not a small event. And the Constitution doesn't read into the other considerations of timing, whether you have the votes, whether it will have a reverse effect. They didn't put all that in, and for very good reason. And so I'm hoping that we can continue this discussion, but that what I'm doing this morning is holding hearings to reveal the fact that there ought to be public knowledge of what's going on in all these attempts at secret hearings on the destruction of these tapes. And I think that will help lead us to what we must ultimately do.
These numbers, Congressman Conyers, quickly, American Research Group, 45% of Americans would back impeachment proceedings against Bush, 54%, that's more than half the American people, would back the same against Cheney. Your response?
Well, I respect whoever they are, but I've got to produce the votes inside the Congress, and that's where our first battle is going to be. I had Ray McGovern in my first Downing Street Memos hearings in the basement a few years back, in which we revealed that the war in Iraq was more preemptive than anything else. But marching into history, I've got to put together a winning program and not step on our message. We've got a lot of legislation to accomplish. The minority party in the House has been, and the Senate too, have been very effective in preventing us from moving forward.
And Congressman Conyers, we're going to leave it there, but go to one of those issues that has been so troubling for so many in this country, and that is what's happening in New Orleans. We're going to turn to a piece now about the demolition of public housing. We want to thank you very much, Chairman Conyers, for joining us, head of the House Judiciary Committee, and Ray McGovern, longtime CIA analyst, actually, was the daily briefer for President Bush. That's President George H.W. Bush when he was vice president. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, New Orleans. Chumbawamba, round them up and throw them in here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to New Orleans, where protests have been occurring for weeks to block the demolition of 4,500 units of public housing. Jackie Suen and Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films are in New Orleans and filed this report. Rick was among those arrested at a march on Saturday.
Since Hurricane Katrina emptied New Orleans of its residents, a battle has been waged over the future of the city. The struggle over what the new New Orleans will look like and who will return to live here largely depends on the future of the city's public housing developments. And this week is a crucial showdown in that fight. The city began demolitions last Wednesday, which, if completed, will destroy 4,500 units of public housing, making way for mixed-income neighborhoods with only 800 units of public housing, an 82% reduction in size. 41,000 affordable rental units were destroyed by Hurricane Katrina, and the city is facing an acute housing shortage. Rents have almost doubled since before the storm, but HUD, the Federal Housing Authority, is pressing ahead with the demolition. 50% of families who want to but are unable to return to New Orleans make less than $20,000 a year. Watching the demolition of part of their housing development from across the street, residents of B.W. Cooper believe that the city does not want them back.
They want us out. I think they want the land right up in here. They want this land right here. If you don't have the money, because the housing's going up, everything going up, so if you poor, you got to get out of here, man. There's no place for you here. None. So that's going to be the new New Orleans.
They want to get rid of all these poor black people, get them completely out. They don't want the project.
They're going to make
condos.
No, they want it to be a rich city. That's what they want.
People we haven't seen, but Hurricane, still having some because they can't come back. They don't have nowhere to stay.
The people don't have nowhere to go. People still homeless, out of town homeless. Go underneath that bridge. They got thousands of people under that bridge home. Bring tears to your eyes when you go out to the food stamp home.
The homeless population of New Orleans has doubled since the storm. Every night, over 12,000 New Orleanians sleep under bridges and crowd into the city's parks. Hundreds pitch their tents and blankets in this plaza in front of City Hall, within sight of the mayor's office. According to Unity, a charity that is working with the city to relocate the plaza's homeless, at least a third of the homeless here work steady jobs.
I make $8 an hour right now, which is not hitting on nothing. You need a job at least starting you off $21 an hour. Then you're okay. $8 an hour after taxes is nothing. It's kid wages. During the hurricane, I was sitting on my porch. I heard him crying over a little transistor radio. I had ran by batteries. You know, I'm talking to the governor, talking about the president. I need to get some help down here. I heard this man crying. I said, all right, you know. But you know what? After all is said and done, he's just like them. So, Mr. Mayor, why don't you give us some help down here? That's all I can say.
It's not because people are vagrants and drunks and bums. Like myself and my husband don't do drugs. We work every day. But we can't afford the housing. They want first month's rent, last month's rent, damage deposit. What used to be $450 a month is now $950 a month. There isn't a lot of intelligent people here. I have a college degree. I was turned down 3 jobs last week because I have no address. I had no idea. And I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. My family worked hard. We were middle class. But I never expected this. I didn't realize how hard this is. And along with the homelessness comes hopelessness. It's hard to look at this every day and to live this. You don't know until you live it. And I don't want people to judge us because we're not vagrants and drunks and drug addicts. We're victims of circumstance. And we're trying. We need some help. Blankets are fine. Food's fine. God bless them for it. But it's a temporary solution to a big, big long-term problem.
The city announced that this Friday it will fence off Duncan Plaza and evict those camped out on the site. After Friday, they will no longer be visible from the mayor's office window, but the homeless population may surge again as FEMA begins closing their trailer parks, which house more than 50,000 families across the region. In the next 6 months, all of FEMA's trailer parks will be emptied.
Stop the bulldozers now!
Stop the bulldozers now!
Stop the bulldozers now!
Stop the bulldozers now!
Activists from across the country came to New Orleans this week to join local residents in actions to save New Orleans public housing.
off here.
Stop the demolition now!
Stop the demolition now!
Stop the demolition now!
Stop the demolition now!
Demolitions in the four largest housing developments were slated to begin on December 15th, but a combination of political pressure and legal action won a temporary reprieve.
Oh, let's say for now, Seven Wall, yay! We gotta take it back!
Now the fate of New Orleans public housing lies in the hands of the City Council. They are scheduled to make their decision this Thursday. The Coalition to Defend New Orleans Public Housing is celebrating their temporary victory and mobilizing for the next phase of their fight. They say that more is at stake than the future of their city. They warn that the new New Orleans is a testing ground for national policies and are calling for support from across the country.
That piece produced by Jackie Suen and Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films in New Orleans. That New Orleans City Council vote will take place today. We'll report back to you tomorrow. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Juan?
Well, the Iowa caucuses are only 14 days away. In the Republican race, polls show former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee has taken a strong lead over Mitt Romney. The latest Washington Post ABC News poll found Huckabee has a support of 35% of likely Republican voters. Romney placed second with 27%. Nationally, the latest Zogby poll shows Huckabee is in a virtual tie with former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. A month ago, Huckabee was 18 points behind.
Much of Huckabee's surge can be linked to his growing support from Christian evangelicals. The former Southern Baptist minister has repeatedly discussed his faith at campaign rallies and in television ads.
Faith doesn't just influence me, it really defines me. I don't have to wake up every day wondering, what do I need to believe?
Let us never sacrifice our principles for anybody's politics. Not now, not ever.
I believe life begins at conception.
We believe in some things. We stand by those things. We live or die by those things.
I'm Mike Huckabee, and I approve this message.
At a recent campaign event at the late Jerry Falwell's school, Liberty University, Mike Huckabee credited prayers from his supporters as a main reason why he was surging in the polls.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
I'm Daniel Webb, and I'm not a government student, but Mr. President, Governor Huckabee.
I like the sound of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, Freudian slip. Recent polls show you surging in many states, including Iowa, where you're statistically tied with Mitt Romney, as well as Florida, where you're second place, and Texas. What do you attribute this surge to?
There's only one explanation for it, and it's not a human one. It's the same power that helped a little boy with two fish and five loaves feed a crowd of 5,000 people. And that's the only way that our campaign could be doing what it's doing. And I'm not being facetious, nor am I trying to be trite. There literally are thousands of people across this country who are praying that a little will become much. And it has, and it defies all explanation. It has confounded the pundits, and I'm enjoying every minute of their trying to figure it out. And until they look at it from a just experience beyond human, they'll never figure it out. And that's probably just as well. That's honestly why it's happening.
Mike Huckabee speaking at Liberty University in Virginia. David Korn is the Washington bureau chief of Mother Jones. He's been closely following the Huckabee campaign, joining us in Washington. Welcome, David. You've not only been looking at Huckabee on the campaign trail, but have been going back in time and looking at his writings as a minister.
Yes, I have. And hello, Amy. What we did, this all started at our bureau of Mother Jones, when we thought, well, wait a second, this is a guy who's running campaign ads saying that he's a Christian leader. So it seems to us fair game then to see what he did as a Christian leader. For 12 years before he entered Arkansas state politics, he was a Baptist pastor at two different churches in Arkansas. So we said, well, let's go look at those churches. Let's look at some of the sermons he gave to get an understanding, a feel of what he thinks about some issues, theological and public affairs issues, which often enter into sermons. And Jonathan Stein, my colleague, called several of the two of those churches. And one said, well, we went through remodeling a few years ago, and we can't find any of his sermons. And the other said, well, we're not going to help you. And then we went to his campaign and said, will you provide copies of his sermons? And the campaign sent back a very brief one-sentence remark saying, we will not be accommodating such requests. Now, if a columnist or a journalist ran for office, it sure would be fair game to look at what they wrote and said for 12 years of their professional life. And sermons are public matters. They're not, you know, we're not talking about what happens within a confessional booth or, you know, private communications. So I think I thought it was kind of weird. So I started looking at other things, other places where we might find Huckabee talking about his beliefs and ideas and what that might mean if he were to become president. And it turns out there's a book he wrote in 1998 called Kids Killing Kids. It was a small book put out maybe even by a sort of a vanity publishing house. Not a big deal. He wrote it very quickly in the months after the Jonesboro school shooting, which happened in Arkansas in March of 1998. And the book is really very much an attack on American culture, blaming the demoralization of America, that's his phrase, for the violence in schools, such as the school shooting in Jonesboro. And it was very much, you know, a common critique of American culture that you would expect from a fundamentalist Christian. But throughout the book, there are some pretty hard-edged remarks. For instance, he writes about the things that are fracturing our society. And he says, in a whole list, he lumps together AIDS, drug abuse, pornography, homosexual activism, and environmentalism. And I would wonder, what does environmentalism have to do with pornography? And in another section of the book, he bemoans that, that, as he calls them, aberrations are being publicly endorsed and supported by institutions in America. And the list of aberrations are homosexuality, pedophilia, and necrophilia. And again, lumping homosexuality with pedophilia and necrophilia, you know, indicates a certain mindset. But I think throughout the book, too, there is... He, of course, is against sex outside of marriage, against no-fault divorce, but he also poo-poos the whole notion of workplace equality for women, sort of indicating that he doesn't really care too much about it and that it's not a good idea. And then towards the end of the book, he has a passage in which he literally says that if you do not believe in God and you do not walk in faith, well, then you're prone to do immoral things. You're prone to be immoral, improvident, and impure. That's saying that if you don't believe in God and you're not religious, you tend to do evil things, or you tend to be immoral, and as he says, engage in destructive behavior. Now, as I wrote in the piece for Mother Jones, which is on motherjones.com, I say he's entitled to all these beliefs, and they're not out of sorts with many Christian fundamentalists. But last week in the final debate before the Republican caucuses in Iowa, he got on the stage and he literally said that this is a very divided country, it's very polarized, and I can unite it, I can bring it together. The question I would pose to Governor Huckabee is, given that you view homosexuals and to be akin to people who practice necrophilia, that you lump together environmentalists with pornographers, and that you say that people who don't believe in God and don't walk in faith, you know, tend to be immoral, it seems to me that you're one of the factors, you're participating in the division of American society. You're adding to the divisiveness, which, again, you're David, free to do.
David, I'd like to ask you also about immigration issue. He's been hit on that in several debates, on his stand while governor of Arkansas on immigration. Some of the contradictions in terms of what he said and what he actually did?
Well, yeah, well, you know, Romney, looking Mitt Romney, who has, you know, who has fallen to second place behind Huckabee in the latest polls in Iowa, has been looking for some way to whack Huckabee over the head again and again. And he certainly can't do it on the social conservative issues because he's flip-flopped in those areas, and Huckabee, you know, does seem to have integrity in terms of his stance. But what he's gone after Huckabee on is this hot-button issue for Republicans of immigration. And, you know, what he's basically, there's one policy issue. Huckabee, when he was governor, supported the idea of giving college tuition assistance to children who were the children of illegal immigrants. Now, not specially for them. He just allowed them to participate in a program that would go to all children in Arkansas on what is actually kind of the Christian notion that you don't punish the children for the sins or crimes or actions of their parents. And Romney's just, you know, keeps hitting him over the head that he wants to give away state money, taxpayer money, to children of illegal immigrants. And it so far hasn't worked. You know, for all the attacks that Romney has leveled on Huckabee in ads and on the campaign trail and talking to reporters, Huckabee has continued to grow in strength in Iowa. Maybe, you know, maybe there will be some trailing off at some point in the next week or two. And then, of course, Huckabee, looking to be not vulnerable in this position, what is he doing? He has now released a plan that basically calls for all people who are here not legally, to go, 11 to 12 million people, as you know, Juan, to go back to where they came from within 120 days, 4 months. It's certainly not a realistic plan and nothing that, you know, this is Huckabee's entry into the demagoguery in the Republican Party on immigration matters.
David Korn, we're going to leave it there. We thank you very much for being with us, D.C. Bureau Chief of Mother Jones Magazine. When we come back from break, we turn to another controversy around Mike Huckabee's past. Stay with us. Charlie Hayden here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan.
I want to turn to another controversy from Mike Huckabee's past. Earlier this month, the Huffington Post revealed that as governor of Arkansas, he aggressively pushed for the early release of Wayne Dumen in 1999. Huckabee made the decision despite being warned by numerous women that Dumen had sexually assaulted them or their family members and would likely strike again. After Dumen was released, he went on to rape and murder at least one other woman. This short video about Dumen was recently posted online on a newly created website called HuckabeeFacts.com.
My name is Lois Davidson. My daughter won't be home for Christmas this year.
Carol Sue Shields won't be home for Christmas because she was brutally murdered by Wayne Dumond. Dumond was in an Arkansas prison for raping a 17-year-old high school cheerleader until Governor Mike Huckabee helped him get out. Thanks to Mike Huckabee, Dumond was released from his Arkansas prison 25 years before his sentence was to end. Then, less than 1 year later, he raped and murdered Carol Sue Shields.
If not for Mike Huckabee, Wayne Dumon would have been in prison and Carol Sue would have been with us this year for Christmas.
that online video was produced by a Republican operative in Arkansas who says he made the video independently of any of Huckabee's opponents. Lois Davidson joins us on the phone now from Missouri, her daughter, Carol Sue Shields, murdered by Wayne DuMont after he was released by Governor Huckabee. We're also joined by Nico Pitney, the national editor for HuffingtonPost.com. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Lois Davidson, this story about Mike Huckabee, the question of how involved was he with the release of Wayne DuMont, who then got out and murdered your daughter?
Well, he went to the school or to the parole board, and he encouraged them to let him out. He thought that he had served enough time, which was only, he only served, I think, 12 years. He was in the pen for life plus 20 years, and to my understanding, he only served 12 years.
Let's put this in some context with Nico Pitney. You're a national editor of the Huffington Post. Murray Wass wrote an extensive piece called Documents Expose Huckabee's Role in Serial Rapist Release. Can you give this the chronology of what happened here, and also respond to the governor's response to this story, this expose, saying he wasn't the one, it was the Democrats on the parole board that actually released him. He didn't weigh in with heavy pressure.
Well,
let's put that to Nico Pitney.
Thank you, Amy. The chronology, DuMont was first imprisoned in the 80s, given a life sentence plus 20 years. What Huckabee says about him being made parole eligible by Jim Guy Tucker is true, but it's basically irrelevant to the controversy of DuMont actually being released from prison. Under Bill Clinton, DuMont's sentence was reduced from life plus 20 years down to 39.5 years. It was under Huckabee in the 1990s, in 1996, that this parole board was pressured to actually release DuMont, and that's when it took place. Now, four members of the parole board have gone on record saying that Huckabee came in. The recording secretary was removed from the room, so no transcription exists, which was virtually unprecedented. Huckabee told them that he favored this man's release, and within a few months, the parole board, which had previously voted several times against releasing DuMont, then switched and voted in favor of releasing him. Huckabee insists that he has no control over the parole board's decision, and he doesn't decide whether prisoners are paroled, but the power he does have is to appoint these members of the parole board, which obviously weighs massively over their minds. He decides whether they keep a high-paying position in the state government, and so clearly he had the potential to influence their minds.
And Nico Pitney, the article by Murray Wass raises some startling information in terms of, we normally think of these campaigns to get leniency for people convicted of crimes as being pressure from civil libertarians or from liberals, but that this was a campaign developed around the country by very conservative groups, including Steve Dunleavy, the extreme conservative columnist of the New York Post, that were pressuring the Arkansas officials to free this man.
That's right. You read Dunleavy's columns today, and they're just vile. I mean, basically accusing this woman who was raped when she was 17 years old by DuMont of making the whole thing up. He claims no rape happened. It's really vile. His line was echoed in Arkansas by a fellow Baptist minister who had a major talk radio show there. This talk radio host was a friend of Huckabee's, was pressing him to release DuMont. The reason was that the reason DuMont was in prison because he had raped a distant relative of Bill Clinton, and the perception among conservatives who were ardently opposed to Clinton was that he was, this man had been falsely imprisoned, had been, even if he was guilty, he had been punished too harshly, and so they had pressured Huckabee to release him reverse this perceived injustice at the hands of Bill Clinton.
And then the issue that you released for the first time in the Huffington Post and Murray Wass's piece of the numerous letters that were sent to, well, Governor Huckabee at the time, pleading with him not to release Dumond. They were letters of women who had been raped or family members of those who had been. Can you talk about why these haven't been seen, what they said, who were these women?
That's exactly right. Murray Wass has been reporting this from 2002. He was the one who first reported that Huckabee had pressured the parole board. What the public didn't know until this past month was that while Huckabee was considering and pressing for this man's release, he had privately been receiving letters from women who had also been raped or sexually assaulted by this man. So even if Huckabee had doubted whether this original crime for which the man was in prison hadn't taken place or was in doubt, there were these other women, the tragic stories that they told. One described being raped by this man while her three-year-old daughter was in the bed. He held a butcher knife to her throat. Another woman described a very similar incident, him arriving in her room with a butcher knife, only to discover that her boyfriend was also in the room, and this man, Wayne Dumond, ran off. But Huckabee had in his possession, he read these letters, in fact, and ended up meeting this this woman who had been raped with her three-year-old in person. He met her and still pushed forward, you know, still bowed to these this right-wing campaign to release this man from prison. He ended up going on, of course, to rape and murder two other women.
Nico Pitney, the other issue are the people that Murray Wass spoke to within the governor's office, his aides who came out, who had these letters and talked about Governor Huckabee wanting to silence this issue, sequester the information, get letters from other agencies to ensure that under Arkansas's liberal FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests, reporters wouldn't be able to get these letters from other agencies.
Exactly. You know, these letters were provided to us by a member of Huckabee's gubernatorial staff who saw all this take place. And this person not only, of course, was alarmed that he had known of other women who had been raped by this man, but when Huckabee was running for governor in 2002, he feared that these documents would come out and made an effort to keep them secret. So he tried to get copies, all the copies that other government agencies had of these letters, and bring them into the governor's office where they couldn't be requested by ordinary citizens seeking information about the case. Basically, tried to cover up the information he had known about this man before he was set free.
I'd like to ask Lois Davidson, when you hear about this information, especially in light of the comments that that Governor Huckabee made in a debate on CNN when he was asked about this, and he said none of us could have predicted what Dumond could have done when he got out, and of course he did get out, and he ended up murdering your daughter. Your reaction to the remarks of Governor Huckabee now about this?
Well, if you go back to Mr. Dumond's back history, he should have known that this something else would happen, because Mr. Dumond has been in trouble ever since the early 1980s, and you just don't change somebody like that.
Lois Davidson and Nico Pitney, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Lois Davidson lost her daughter, Carol Sue Shields, murdered and raped by Wayne Dumond after he was released by Governor Huckabee. Nico Pitney, national editor of The Huffington Post, will link to Murray Wass's piece on our website at democracynow.org as we wrap up this broadcast today. Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Shrufa Bocaduce, Aaron Mattei, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Peter Curry's our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, Rebecca Silver, Jaisal Noor, John Randolph, Jose Miranda, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Laura Chipley, Travis Collins, Vesta Godars. Our website is democracynow.org. There you can get our headlines, video, and audio podcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!